I'm Katie Auth.
I'm Rose Matiso, and this is High Energy Planet, the podcast from the Energy for Growth Hub about new ideas to solve global energy poverty.
Today, we're here with Hannah Ritchie, the deputy editor and lead researcher at Our World in Data. Hannah is a data scientist and a science communicator, and her work uses data to tell stories about environmental sustainability, including climate change, energy, food and ag, biodiversity, a whole host of issues. And often her analysis upends the common consensus around certain topics and makes us reconsider long-held assumptions. 2023 has been a big year for Hannah. She joined the Energy for Growth Hub as a fellow. Yay! She gave a big TED Talk on climate optimism, which now has close to 1 million views. And she just published her first book, Not the End of the World.
We're so excited to have Hannah on the show. And for me in particular, this is super exciting. So I'm based in London and I always look forward to hearing Hannah on the radio, on the BBC. She's a frequent contributor. And Hannah, I can actually recognize your voice just when I hear it. The radio is often in the background. I'm like, yeah, that's Hannah. And it's always super exciting. As a full-time energy nerd, I obviously really appreciate her thorough research and analysis. It's really rigorous work. But what really stands out for me in addition to that is Hannah's dedication to science communication. And this is an aspect that's often overlooked by researchers. So whether she's on the news, writing, or speaking, Hannah really goes the extra mile to share her insights with diverse audiences. And this commitment means that she's playing a significant role in reshaping our perspectives on intractable environmental challenges and really underscores why we need more researchers to take science communication as seriously as Hannah does. So thank you so much for this massive public service.
And on my end, I'm really interested in the way that Hannah prompts her readers to reconsider their priors. So I think there are certain narratives that we've broadly accepted about what's going on in the world and global trends and environmental health. And typically we tend to assume that everything sucks and is getting worse. But what if that's not the whole story? So Hannah kind of opens up the aperture to look at what the data is really pointing to and why we might not be as doomed as we tend to think. So we'll talk about that. And we'll also talk to her about how her environmental analysis links to global human development and how she thinks about imperatives like expanding energy access and increasing energy consumption in the face of environmental problems. So let's get into it. Hannah, welcome to High Energy Planet. Thank you so much for being with us.
No, thanks for the lovely intro.
So we always start out with our guests by asking them if they can tell us something about how and where you grew up and how it shaped the work that you do today.
Yeah, so I grew up in a little town in Scotland called Falkirk. And I think a really key thing that shaped my trajectory is like I think I'm now from a generation that kind of climate change has like always been on the radar. And I think for me, it was on the radar like very, very early as a kid. I think in some sense, I was also like a little bit of an anxious kid. I would like worry about stuff, like a lot of stuff, like really far off into the future. Like I remember like stressing over, you know, how I would ever be able to afford a house when I was like five. So I think I probably already had
in the UK, fair enough.
Yeah, I mean, I've still got that anxiety now. That's never left. So probably I was like already quite an anxious kid about forward-looking stuff. And for climate change, that's just like a very obvious match. So I remember like as a kid, like even, you know, I remember in English class when I was maybe like 12 or 13, we had to give like a presentation to the class on like any topic. And people, like other classmates, were picking like their favorite hobby or like football. And I picked climate change and I just like freaked the class out because I stood at the front holding maps of what the world would look like 2 degrees, 3 degrees, 4, and you just saw the coastlines getting swallowed up. Yeah, I think that's where a lot of my work comes from today, is like still thinking about this climate problem. And then I studied environmental science at university, you know, that just embedded the not only climate change, but all of the other massive environmental problems that we face. So I think that was just like really key in shaping kind of my trajectory and what I focus on now.
What a trajectory you've been on, from like intense like anxiety from being a little kid. And now you just published a book that has literally been called An Antidote to Climate Despair. All three of us have struggled with this feeling of being overwhelmed by climate change, and many people do. And we even get emails from folks asking us about feeling overwhelmed. And we often point them to you because this is something that you've really made a big mission of yours, is to combat despair. So tell us about the moment that you realized that this anxious reaction to climate change wasn't healthy or wasn't serving you, and how you took the first step towards changing your outlook. and getting to this point where you're really like the face of the opposite reaction?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd clarify that I think the anxiety is still there for me. Like, I'm still really concerned. I still lose a lot of sleep over this problem. And I think in some sense, anxiety is a healthy reaction. Like, a sense of anxiety is often about uncertainty, which on the trajectories we're on, the future is very uncertain. And in some sense, it's a kind of human response to fret. So I think the anxiety is totally valid, and I still feel it. Where I think my perspective has changed is that I think the level of anxiety was so deep that I couldn't see any way out of it. Like, I think at that point in time, I felt so hopeless. I felt like, you know, we just were impossible at solving problems, and they would just get worse and worse and worse. I think a really key turning point for me was discovering the work of Hans Rosling. He was like a Swedish statistician. He would give these amazing TED Talks and show how the world had changed over centuries. Now, he didn't focus on environmental problems really, but he focused on the human lens. I think the problem I had at that stage is that all of the environmental trends were getting worse, but I was also assuming, based on nothing, just based on news headlines, that everything else in the world must be getting worse. So child mortality, hunger, poverty, just, you know, the world was falling apart. And I think he showed me that on many of these human well-being metrics, my framing was completely upside down. And all of these things were getting better. It was just coming at the cost of the environment. So I think I've spent the last decade kind of trying to grapple with these two things of how do we continue to improve human well-being while also tackling environmental problems at the same time? And I think on the environmental problems, I think it's not that we're on a good trajectory. It's not that these problems are solved or we can be complacent. But I think there are some signals in there that change, environmental change, is possible. I think we are starting now to see really significant steps in the right direction. And actually, some environmental problems we've actually solved, like the ozone layer, acid rain, even local air pollution in many rich countries is way, way down on where it was. So I think by studying the data, I can now see that, you know, there is actually solutions there, and they are actually happening. It's just about how we accelerate that.
You're talking about a whole range of both environmental and human development issues and the ways that they're connected and trends across all of them. And one thing that Rose and I noticed when we were kind of looking at how the media has been covering the book launch is that although your book focuses on a lot of different topics, a lot of the media attention has focused pretty narrowly on the climate issue. And we were curious, what gets lost from your message if people focus too narrowly on climate and not enough on all the other stuff that you cover?
I mean, the media can cover it how they want to cover it. But like, yeah, I've been a little bit frustrated that it's just only focused on climate. I mean, I cover 7 big environmental problems in the book, and they're all really significant and they're all really strongly linked. Like, I think like a big thing that just gets missed is the health burden of air pollution, which in some sense, like if you look currently, it's actually arguably a bigger problem than climate changes. Now, that could change in the future, but the burden, health burden of air pollution today is really, really massive. And there are actually like pretty good solutions we could have there to significantly reduce that burden quite quickly. I think there are other elements that I think are just so important. Even if you're only looking through a climate lens, like food and agriculture is so crucial. Like for me, one of the biggest risks of climate change is how it impacts food systems and agriculture. And to me, like the food chapter covers, like we have a host of solutions there. There's so much low-hanging fruit on how to improve food security and combine that with alleviating environmental pressures. So I think there are a host of other problems that I think people just don't look at, and they only look at the climate lens, which gives you a very, very narrow focus on the problem and also the solutions.
Part of the challenge for many people is kind of needing the sense, like there are so many sprawling issues and you kind of want a mechanism to prioritize. And because the climate lens can link many different things. And, you know, I think there's just like a tendency to just want to simplify and narrow down and feel like you're working on the thing that matters. And one thing I found really interesting in your book is you had the schematic based on an idea that Ken Caldera and others had shared about, you know, people pulling in the same direction. Like you could be working on many different things. Could you just share a little bit more on this? Because we often hear, especially a lot of like younger people asking for career advice and stuff like that, and shaped very much by this sense of what should I be working on? What is the thing that will make the biggest difference? Like how do you respond to that?
Yeah, so I think in the book, I've got a schematic, and this was inspired by, I think it was Ken Caldera that I saw it, but he maybe got it from Andrew Desler. So like, I mean, there are a range of people.
I love your commitment to like citation and referencing the right person.
I don't want to take any credit for it. But yeah, it's like a diagram where if you imagine like a center, and this is our problems, and there's loads of arrows pointing in one direction. And those are people trying to pull us in the right direction to make progress on this problem. And we all have like our favorite solution to this stuff, right? People have their favorite energy solution or their favorite food solution. And I think what we often see is that where we fight with people the most are people that are largely really strongly aligned with us, right? We all are trying to move in that direction. It's just that your arrow might be like 10 degrees off to my right and someone else to 10 degrees to my left. And we fail to recognize that we're trying to pull in the same direction. And the risk is that we spend so much time fighting amongst ourselves. And the problem is that there are arrows pulling in the other direction that don't want us to move forward. The risk is that we focus all our attention on our kind of in-group fighting, and we fail to recognize, you know, what's the actual problem that we're trying to solve. So there's issue like here, you know, you get nuclear, really pro-nuclear people will fight with really pro-renewable people. You get we should move to meat substitute crowd, get angry with the we should eat, you know, more raw plant-based diet crowd. There's loads of people that are really largely strongly aligned, but they fail to recognize it. I think what's important in this space is to try and recognize, you know, who we are aligned with and make sure we're not spending all of our time just trying to dunk on them.
All right. So, okay. Speaking of prioritization, you do make quite a bold statement in the book, and you state that pulling people out of poverty is the number one strategy for adapting to climate change. I think this is something a lot of people would find quite surprising, especially in the climate space. Not many people understand the poverty world or the development world. And so could you kind of explain that in more detail? Like, what are the key data trends you see that make poverty alleviation so important to the point that you say, like, this is the most important thing we should be doing for climate change adaptation?
Yeah, so if you look at the history, for example, over the last century of deaths from disasters, you would assume that those were going up significantly because of climate change and the impacts of climate change. But actually, when you look at the trend over the last century, they've largely gone down. You get lots of year-to-year variation. That's often caused by earthquakes. They tend to be like the most fatal disasters now. But the overall like general trend is downwards. Now, it's not downwards because climate change isn't happening or isn't making extreme weather more severe. It's going down because we've become much more resilient to disasters. So we have early warning systems. We have more resilient infrastructure. If there is a disaster, aid gets there much faster than it would in the past. So we become much more resilient to disasters. Now, there's nothing to say that that trend continues. Like, climate disasters will continue to escalate, and probably non-linearly. If we fail to equip people with the resilience to tackle them and withstand them, then disaster deaths will start to go up. But that's a key part of this equation. Like, the impacts from climate change will not only be about the actual physical climate impact, which is what most people focus on, like how strong is the disaster. It's about also one, like vulnerability, so the number of people in the way. So that means the number of people on a coastline if the sea level rises, or the number of people in a particular region that are exposed to a heat wave. And then the final part of that is, you know, resilience. And that is, do the people in that region have air conditioners or ways to get out of the heat? Are there ways where you can build a seawall so the sea level doesn't rise? Especially the last part of that equation is largely related to poverty. When you're in poverty and you rely on farming as your key source of income and you get a bad harvest, that's your whole basically annual income gone. So I think this last part of the equation of managing to lift people out of poverty is so crucial to limit the damages.
So the next step, the follow-on from that, I think is obviously like, how do we advance those anti-poverty goals without intensifying the climate impact? How do we move away from a space in which those two goals are often considered kind of fundamentally at odds, right? And I know that's something that you care about and something that we've written a lot about as well. I'm curious, when you think about how we move into a space where universal energy access, for example, or universal poverty alleviation are not at odds with climate, what are some of the big questions that you think are still outstanding about how we do that?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think it's like an area that's probably quite contested about how you do that. I mean, there's just this general consensus that, you know, development just leads to more CO2 emissions. Therefore, you know, a big issue with climate change is that, you know, we can't develop. I think there's a couple of key questions there or key points there. I think if you are to like really look at what would be the climate impact of alleviating the worst levels of poverty in the world, it's actually really small. It really makes very, very little difference to global CO2 emissions. So if we're going to say, no, it's not acceptable for people to move out of poverty because of climate, that's just such a bad argument. And I think that also relates to some of our perspectives around financing of energy in particular countries. Like, I think there is this kind of Western high income forcing of, no, we won't finance your fossil fuel projects because that's bad for the climate. Even though in the rich world, we're still extracting lots of fossil fuels. If you want to develop in a way that's high carbon, then we won't accept that. And I think that's really, really damaging, because I think just alleviating poverty at the lowest incomes would have very, very little impact on climate. The broader question is, I mean, the ideal would be that these two would be completely compatible, right? You could provide low carbon energy at a really low cost, and therefore you could just skip fossil fuels altogether. I think there are really big questions there of like how feasible that is right now. How long would it be until that's just the absolute default? Like, I could see there being a trajectory by which we get there. I'm just not sure if that applies to every sector and the timeframes from that. Like, there's this concept of like leapfrogging, which I really, really want to believe in, but I think we lack empirical evidence, like strong empirical evidence at the moment that that's what's happening or could happen in the near term.
So it's really interesting and ties back to something you talk about in the book about being a conditional or pragmatic optimist. And you borrow this language again, attributing very well to Paul Romer, the economist. But, you know, so on one hand, you know, you have so much optimism about the trend lines, technology costs coming down, a real opportunity, like you say in your TED talk, to be the first sustainable generation and to kind of create this new energy and economic future. But on the other hand, the nitty gritty, like what you're saying, is it's not clear if leapfrogging, you know, is going to save us all in the timeline that we needed to happen. So how do you place yourself in this, having established yourself as an optimist? How do you balance these complicated nuances that kind of tamper down the optimism, if you will, like in the specific situation of the leapfrogging potential in poor countries?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. Like, I think I try to frame myself as an optimist based on the data that I can see and the trends moving in the right direction. I think the way I differentiate it, and as Paul Romer differentiated it, is that you get optimists that just assume, yeah, this is going to be great and things will just continue to get better. And I guess that's maybe like this feeling of, yeah, the technology trends, the prices are going down, so I'm sure this will just happen. And I think that's like a really wrong approach to take. I think my optimism is based on this belief, valid or not, that I think that we can make a difference if we really work at it. So I think it's predicated totally on human action rather than let's just let the trends flow and it will just all work out. And I think it is really hard to balance. You need to continually update based on the latest data, and you should probably hold your opinions quite loosely and be very, very willing to change your mind, which I'm always open to.
I think part of what makes the optimism difficult sometimes is because it's easier in some ways to look at the data and think about what we should do. And I think your work does that really well. It's a whole other question to think about how humans can actually organize themselves and overcome all of the political entrenched interests and all of the geopolitical stuff that's going on. That's a messy, really complicated space. Curious whether you think scientists like yourself, who are focused on the data, do you have any role to play in that broader question of how you move from what should we do to how do we do it?
I'm always quite cautious on this because I kind of take the view, it's a hard line to walk, but I also try in the book to not be like really prescriptive and say this is what we have to do and this is what we should do. I think the role of scientists is to lay out, well, one, to make clear like, these are the problems, this is the scale of the problem, this is what we could expect. But also, even on the solution side, is to lay out, these are the potential solutions, these are the pros and cons of these solutions, this is what happened to your CO2 emissions if you deploy this amount of solar power. And I think that's what we can do really strongly. I don't think it's necessarily our place to mandate that or say this is what we have to do or what we should do. But as I say, like, I think that's like a really hard line to walk, because obviously I have strong opinions of what we should do. I think to maintain kind of scientific credibility and try to be as non-biased as possible, you kind of need to try and reel that in a little bit.
Do you find that hard to hold back on your personal preferences, your opinions? Do you have to make a conscious effort to kind of sideline that part of yourself?
Yeah, I do find it difficult. Like, I do like have quite strong opinions on what we should do. And I get really frustrated when things are not moving in the direction that I think they should be moving in. So it is hard to rein that in sometimes, but like I try my best. I think it's also really important, especially when you're speaking to like a really wide range of audiences, because they will all react very differently to your suggested solutions. I think you need to be really, really cautious, especially not to alienate potential people, especially when we're thinking about this diagram of like pulling in the right direction. I think if you go in with really, really super prescriptive solutions, then arrows that are aligned, like closely aligned with you, start to get angry.
So I find this so interesting because I was finishing up my PhD. This was in the kind of late noughties. And it was a time when there was a sense that there was really rising anti-science sentiment, which actually looking at where we are now, maybe that was just the beginning of it. Scientists started to have a real political awakening. There were a lot of scientific marches. And I actually ended up doing a postdoc in government. And this, it was a scheme specifically to get scientists engaged with policy, to understand how they impact policy and policy impacts them. And there's a sense of there's an attack on science and science funding. I think a lot of my scientific identity has really been built around this idea that scientists, we need to be part of these policy conversations. Looking back at the trend lines now, I think your perspective is giving me food for thought. I don't know how much where kind of scientists, you know, this different brand of being a scientist in the world, how these coexist. I don't know if there's a role for us in this more politicized part of the spectrum, trying to kind of make and agitate and make noise for science, if that has done more harm than good. I think this is giving me a lot of food for thought.
I guess there's also a broader discussion, like what does activism mean? I'm always going to say, I think climate change is a really big problem. We need to tackle it. Like, is that me being an activist? Because I'm saying we need to take action on this. It's not that I don't think scientists shouldn't be at all involved in policy discussions. I think they can play a really strong like advisory role on policy discussions. So if a politician wants to set, you know, a particular carbon reduction target, like scientists can be really heavily involved in saying like, these are the different scenarios, these are the different options, here are the pluses and minuses of those. I think the risk is that we go in with like a really strong prescription. So I think that's where I think the risk tips the other way.
One thing I do agree with in your book and in your writing and speaking is I do have a sense that just in my career so far, climate has become depoliticized. And I think you make points about how people are making choices about renewable energy investments and that kind of thing predicated on the technology or the economics or your brother with his Tesla and whatnot. I think the trend lines are positive. So we must be doing something right as kind of scientists of different stripes.
I get some pushback on this. It's not that I don't think politics matters. I mean, it actually does really matter. I think my concern is that like tackling climate change or any of these other environmental problems, this is like a multi-decade problem. We operate in a world where there are different types of governments, like left and right across the world at any one time. Even in any one country, you're going to get swings back and forward from right to left over the decades. The emphasis has to be, we need to find a way of framing climate solutions so that they are persistent. Well, it's not just like one step forward, two steps back every time you switch governments. So I think that's, for me, where I think the trying to depoliticize as much as possible is key, because we need to create climate action and policies that will withstand left wing and right wing and a whole range of different governments across the world.
Well, and the different shapes and forms that those swings are going to take depending on what country you're looking at. And I think that's a challenge in all of this is like, climate change is obviously a global problem and your own work tackles issues that are transnational in so many ways. But the relevance of any particular policy solution is going to be very localized. The relevance of it, but also, you know, as you mentioned earlier, like the degree to which people in that country, in that context, are going to want to sign on and want to support something. So that is a tricky kind of conflict there.
I've highlighted this example in the US before, where like a lot of action at the US is relegated to the state level. And there again, you've got this whole mosaic of like Democrat and Republican states. And actually, interestingly, when you look at the data, you'd assume climate in the US is actually very partisan. It's probably like one of the most partisan countries in the world on climate, but much, much less partisan on clean energy. So actually, when you look at trends of wind and solar deployment in the US, like especially for wind, like the top five states are all Republican. Now, they're not all Republican because Republican states really care about the climate. It's just that they're in a really windy zone where, you know, you get really good economic returns. People like energy security. There are benefits to the local community. So there are ways of framing climate solutions which can be depoliticized by focusing on different stuff, even if it's not related to climate, by focusing on energy security or local benefits of clean energy. I think that's, for me, what's really key, is that we manage to take as many people with us as we can. And that might mean just like shutting up about climate for a little bit, depending on the audience that you're speaking to. And for me, that's really hard. I want to like tell everyone to act based on climate.
You're still that schoolgirl with your poster of the...
Yeah. Maybe talk more about affordable housing.
Right, exactly.
For younger generations to pivot. Okay, so I just want to circle back to one more kind of nerdy question, coming back down from these kind of more philosophical questions around when and how we should act. So data quality and availability is a chronic problem in low-income countries, especially in comparison to richer countries. So we know that even in rich countries, this is a big issue. So, you know, your role is to look at all of this long-term data, usually from existing sources, to come up with these kind of insights that are hidden when we don't take the long view. So to what extent does this approach that prioritizes analyzing lots of data inevitably pay less attention to countries that have massive data gaps and bias us towards an understanding of the world that disproportionately reflects the places where the data is widespread? And if so, what do we do about it?
Yeah, it's a good question. And yeah, there's massive data quality issues across the world, not even just on like energy and environment stuff, but also on like we do lots on health and poverty. Mm-hmm. And for many of those indicators, like the statistical capacity in many countries is really, really poor. I think it does slant our bias on solutions in particular, with a focus on rich countries where we just have good data and we can monitor what's happening. I think there is the potential that we start to get better at this using technology. Like I think there are now ways of trying to do this in a better way using AI or using satellites, or like a big data quality issue, for example, was like I cover overfishing in the book, and we have like pretty good fishing data for richer countries, but there are like some parts of the oceans where we just have very little understanding of what's going on. And actually, in that case, the key problem with overfishing is that you can actually sustainably fish if you can monitor what are the levels of fish populations, how much can you sustainably take out, and you can like set quotas on how much fishermen can catch. But you don't have any data on what fish populations are there, and like put limits on how much fishermen can catch. You can probably assume in many regions that they're overfishing, like just because you don't have the data to monitor and adapt to that. But there are now, you know, methods that are coming online. Like there's the Global Fishing Watch, like recently just published like a whole global analysis where they can basically track entire fishing activity across the world. And there are illuminating regions where we had very, very poor data before. So I think the statistical quality will improve, but I think there are just still massive gaps, which in some sense might underestimate the scale of the problem in particular regions.
Well, I was just curious, if you could wave a magic wand today and close one global data gap, what would you pick?
Probably death registrations and what people die from. Like I think on health data for many countries, like just so many deaths are just not even registered. And we just don't know what people have died from. And I think that really affects our, I mean, there's a way that we can like model and estimate and try and get a rough estimate. But I think it really undersells our ability to understand like what are the major health problems. Mm-hmm. How many people are dying? How are the trends changing? I think for me, that would be like a massive data gap to fill.
The COVID crisis definitely underscored how nobody's kind of doing that right. One other thing I just wanted to highlight for the listeners, Hannah's book, just came out, but you also released a database online that points to all of your data sources and a deeper dive for anyone who wants to see where the data comes from. So I think that was really, really cool. Could you just comment on why you did that, why you wrote a book and then created a whole site that put all of the detailed data and created all this extra work for yourself? Why was that really important for you?
Yeah, I think a couple of reasons. I think one is I have some charts in the book, but you know, you can't put like 200 countries on a chart in a book. And I often show like one or only like a small selection. And I think everyone's interested in like, oh, how is my country doing on CO2 mm-hmm. emissions? So I wanted to put the interactive charts up there so people can go and explore what's happening for their country or another country. So it's not just biased to the countries I show in the book. I think two is that it's just important to be like transparent about data sources, and people can go and dig into the sources and see how the data is constructed and compare it to other sources. And then three is that I think my work like entirely relies on the amazing work of data providers and researchers. And I wanted to like, I mean, you can flick to the end of the book and see the reference list, but I wanted to like try and highlight them a bit as well. So people are forwarded on to like their original work and can see it. I don't do any of the original research myself. I just say what they're saying.
That's super cool. Thanks so much for doing that. I hope it's a new trend in nonfiction publishing.
Yeah, and we definitely look forward to using all of that data. So thank you, Hannah. All right, we have one last question, which is something we ask all of our guests, which is, looking back, what do you think is the biggest thing that's changed about you personally since you started this work?
I think I've become less angry. I think when I was younger, I had this, in some sense, it's very valid. And I think many people feel that I just have this intense anger at like inequality in the world and like the level of suffering. And I think I had this kind of perspective that like there was just such large amounts of suffering and no one cared. And I think I felt very, very angry about that. And to some extent, like the anger is still there a bit, because there are still massive inequalities in the world and it's extremely unfair. But I think a little bit of that's faded because I have a better grasp on like how complex these issues are. I think I used to just think it was just a really simple solution. You could just click your fingers and maybe if you could just like share all the world money between everyone, that would just solve everything. And I think I've realized it's just a bit more complex than that. So maybe my anger's dialed down a bit and now it's maybe replaced with confusion. Because I also just don't know what the solution is. Probably recently I had the moment of like turning around, like imagining like, oh, where are the adults? And realizing, oh no, I'm one of the adults. No,
that's terrifying.
We're definitely getting older. But I mean, I think for a confused person, you did a very good job of writing a very cogent book about solutions and what we can do about it. I mean, if this is you confused, I look forward to seeing you even less confused.
Okay, Hannah, now it's time to play Short Circuit, which is our rapid fire round of questions. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. Number one, what's your favorite productivity tip?
Get up early in the morning.
Okay, you and Todd are both early risers. Todd is our boss and he loves to get up early. Okay, what's the most underappreciated thing about Scotland?
Oh, I think how friendly people are. I mean, if you can understand the accents, then you can realize that we're actually the same. I mean, I think the Scottish accent often sounds quite harsh, so it sounds like we're always angry.
No, I love the Scottish accent.
People are saying.
Yeah. I'm laughing because, not to generalize and use stereotypes, I was literally just telling a friend of mine from Kenya who was visiting the UK that Scottish people are the nicest people in the UK. So I'm giving myself points for being correct, but taking points away for generalizing, but that's really cool.
So you obviously did not enter a traditional academic pathway, but if you had become a traditional academic, what's one course that you would love to teach?
Oh, global development. I think that's what I was really lacking from my like environmental degree. It was like, we just went straight into like pure, like, here is a rock, let's study a rock. When actually I would have wanted to know like kind of the Hans Rosling stuff, like what's happening to global poverty, what's happening to hunger, like health. I think just an overall broad course on that would have like really helped me understand the world a little bit better.
All right, so fill in the blank. No overthinking, just kind of chop, chop, boom, 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 okay? All right, climate change is blank.
Serious.
Okay, that's true. I was hoping you'd say solvable, but I'll take serious.
No. Serious and solvable.
Stay on brand, Hannah. Okay. The future will be blank.
Better.
I like that one. Science cannot blank.
solve everything on its own.
Awesome.
Yeah, that's a good response.
What's the one sentence message that you most want young people to absorb from your work?
The world can be much better for everyone in the future if we work for it today.
Thank you so much for being on the podcast with us, Hannah, for your great work, sharing all these amazing insights that are giving us a sense of well-grounded and well-founded optimism. And we look forward to seeing what you have up your sleeve next and hopefully bring you back on the show to discuss your next project. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Hannah.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, so that's it for today's show. High Energy Planet is a production of the Energy for Growth Hub, matching policymakers with evidence-based pathways to a high energy future for everyone. Find out more at energyforgrowth.org and share your questions and thoughts with us at Energy for Growth on X and LinkedIn.
If you liked today's episode, be sure to rate and review the podcast and tell a friend about us. Audrey Zenner is our executive producer. Join us next time for more High Energy Planet.